Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment with former Secretary of Labor and current Professor of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley, Robert Reich. He joins us to discuss the economic hostage crisis situation going on in Washington, D.C., as the full faith and credit of the United States is subject to blackmail and reckless brinkmanship, while economic recovery and creating jobs takes a back seat to the so-called deficit and debt crisis. Then Jeff Madrick, the author of a new book, Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, joins us. He is an economic policy consultant and analyst, and will explain the dismal economic trajectory we are on and how we got there. Then finally, with South Sudan now officially the world's 193rd nation, we will speak with author and journalist Rebecca Hamilton, who has just returned from the war front at the dividing line between North and South Sudan. She will give us an update on the reality on the ground, far from the lofty pronouncements in the United Nations Security Council, as this new nation, born out of war, faces an uncertain future. I'm now joined by Robert Reich, author of the new book, Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. He has served in three national administrations, most recently as Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton. He is the Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Reich.
Hi, Ian.
And as I mentioned in the opening, here we are in an economic hostage crisis situation going on in Washington, D.C., as the full faith and credit of the United States is subject to blackmail and reckless brinkmanship, while economic recovery and creating jobs takes a back seat to the so-called deficit and debt crisis. Talk about aftershock. I mean, I can't believe this.
Well, you can't believe it. I can't believe it. I think most Americans are in absolute well, either worried or in awe of what's happening. I mean, the Washington has grind to a complete halt in the worst possible way. Most Americans desperately need some bold action on the jobs front. No jobs are being created. Essentially, 18,000 new jobs in June, when you consider the size of the jobs problem, is nothing. We need a jobs plan. We need the president and Congress to be working on jobs and wages to get the economy going again. And here we have a breakdown over an issue that should be a technical matter. Raising the debt limit is something that Congresses do routinely. The economy grows. The debt naturally, inevitably, is going to grow somewhat, whether you have a long-term debt problem or not. And we do have to get on with some sort of long-term deficit plan. That's true. But now is not the time to stop the government and disturb and possibly threaten the full faith and credit of the United States when we've got such a jobs crisis in front of us.
Well, in your recent article in the Huffington Post, Robert Reich, you say that Mitch McConnell, the Republican Senate leader, like most other Republican leaders, has all along seen the battle over raising the debt ceiling as part of a master plan to unseat Obama. And you recall, of course, his famous statement that his top goal is to defeat President Obama in 2012. He just reiterated that with Laura Ingraham on a radio show, and even went further in his determination. And he's saying, we're not going to help Obama out of this mess. Well, they put him in this situation. I don't know why Obama allowed himself to get in this situation. This is an entirely artificial crisis. In a way, my question to you, Professor Reich, is, power is what you give to others. Why did he buy into this narrative?
I have no idea. In fact, what he's done essentially is to indirectly legitimize the Republican narrative that the budget deficit is our largest national problem, and that somehow if you get control over the deficit, we will get the economy going again. Nothing could be further from the truth. The vast majority of economists, of policy analysts, people who understand the American economy, understand that the problem right now is that consumers are so scared, and with good reason. They are scared of losing their jobs, their wages are declining, that they are not buying. Purchasing power is dropping. And if they're not buying, then obviously businesses are not hiring. And if businesses are not hiring, we just find ourselves in a vicious cycle. The only way out of this is for government to boost what's called technically in aggregate demand. I mean, we're talking about boosting the purchasing power of people by I've come up with several ideas. I don't claim that they are necessarily the only ideas or the best ideas, but government has got to act. We've seen in the past, every time we've had a recession, every time we've had a depression, every time we've had this degree of pain and misery and hardship that the American people have endured, government has got to be there for them. This is what this is the American tradition, and the president should never have allowed the Republicans to be in the position of extorting, and it is extortion, this kind of a lack of action.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor and now Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley. You served longer than anybody else in Bill Clinton's cabinet, so you've spent some time, obviously, in Washington. I can't understand, though, how that the culture in Washington doesn't understand, and I think this is both largely with the Republicans, but I think the Democrats share some blame here. They don't seem to understand the pain that's out there with the joblessness and the uncertainty of the economy and the downsizing of a lot of people's lives and the foundation of this country's American dream and meritocracy in jeopardy. They seem to be in their own world, and let's face it, they've all got jobs. And, you know, you read about Ryan, who wants to take Medicare away from seniors, in Politico, having these lunches with lobbyists with $350 bottles of wine. What's going on there? I mean, don't they get it?
I think what's going on, Ian, is that Washington has become its own vicious, very partisan echo chamber in which small tactical victories or losses become the issue of the day. The Washington media exaggerates all of these tactical maneuvers, and Washington itself is deluged with money. Campaign money, lobbyist money, most of it coming from big business executives, from Wall Street and Wall Street executives. And so you get a tremendous distortion, a kind of out of touch with the rest of the country, with main streets, with average working people, who in turn feel completely turned off, cynical. They don't feel that they're being listened to. They say, why bother? Which is itself a self-fulfilling prophecy, because if most average people say, why bother, I don't have anything to do with this government, then they, in effect, cede control over the government to the very forces that don't care about them.
Well, Professor Reich, it's clear at this point that politics have overwhelmed economics, and I'm astounded equally that the president in his recent press conference said that once we make this big fix, we can get back to doing jobs. Well, that seems to me he's got it backwards there. But if we are in a situation where politics are dictating the situation, and it does seem that the Republicans might have a strategy to win with a bad economy, and the Democrats, if the economy is wrecked, they're the ones that will be stuck with the wreckage. So do you think that if the president can call their bluff to the point where it seems that he's maneuvering them and they're trying to maneuver themselves, each side seems to be painting themselves into a corner here, but the notion is that at the end of the day, who gets blamed for the debt crisis and the resulting damage to the economy, no matter what, who gets blamed? If the Republicans get blamed, the president's going to be stuck with it, and he's going to be stuck with it for a whole year.
You see, I think the sad reality, Ian, and I say this advisedly, I don't say this carelessly, is that many Republicans, if not most Republicans in Congress, don't mind a very bad economy going into an election year, because people will blame the president. And Americans traditionally toss presidents out of their jobs when the economy is terribly bad. And so the Republicans have this kind of ulterior motive going. And I hate to say this, publicly, but it seems to me there's no other explanation for why they so blatantly and brazenly have turned their backs on the problem of jobs, and also have held the government up to this sort of extortion. I don't think the debt limit in the end will not be raised. That is, I think it will be raised. Moody's, the credit rating agency, Wall Street in general, big business, all of them who contribute mightily to the Republican Party, that is, Wall Street and big business, they want the debt ceiling raised. They don't want an economic calamity. So I think in the end it will be raised. And I think in the end Mitch McConnell's compromise or something like it will come into being. That is, Republicans will have, through some mechanism, a means of voting against raising the debt limit. The president will raise it nonetheless. The debt limit, at least until the election, will be raised. But you see, the public will not have the benefit of the leadership it needs to have on the jobs front. Right now, the president needs to be fighting for American jobs. We do have to have a WPA, a new Civilian Conservation Corps, exempting the first $20,000 of income from the payroll tax to put more money in people's pockets, amending the bankruptcy laws so homeowners who are distressed right now and behind their payments can declare bankruptcy on their primary residence, have more bargaining leverage with the banks. There are so many things that can be done and should be done to alleviate the pain and suffering going on right now that this entire game of chicken between Republicans and Democrats over the debt ceiling is a diversion, a digression, and it's a very shameful one.
Well, I know I had a rather confusing, long-winded question there, but to try and simplify it, I'm trying to understand what actual leverage the president has in the notion that the Republicans could get blamed for shutting down, not in this case shutting down the government, but essentially creating an economic crisis with the debt ceiling.
Well,
because the wreckage, in other words, it would be a Pyrrhic victory, wouldn't it?
I'll give you two, and I'll be brief. There are two points of leverage the president has. Number one, going into 2012, the Republicans do not want to be tarred with bringing the American economy down. And that's exactly what would happen if the debt limit were not raised and the full faith and credit of the United States were no longer any good. That would be a calamity, and it would be on the Republicans' heads because the president has put forward a plan to reduce the budget deficit. It's no longer about the budget deficit. It's about the Republicans' insistence on a smaller government, an ideological proposition that has nothing whatever to do with the budget deficit nor with raising the debt limit. And secondly, number two, pressure is growing from Wall Street and big business because the credit rating of the United States is affecting the cost of doing business, or will surely in a very short time affect the cost of doing business in the United States.
So do you think then it appears that the president's trying to use this leverage, who's going to blink? Because as I say, my concern is that the wreckage, even though you could blame the Republicans for it because they were the ones that precipitated this and pushed it to the limit, he's still going to be stuck with a bad economy through an election year, and people's memories aren't that long, and I don't know that that's going to work.
We've got to have some faith here that although some members of Congress play nothing but a cynical or ideological game, that there are leaders in both parties, and I think John Boehner, for example, is one of them. Mitch McConnell, in his proposal that he came up with a couple of days ago, is another. These Republican leaders understand the calamitous consequences of not raising the debt limit, and wise heads and responsible heads will prevail. Look, we're at a turning point in American politics, in the sense that if a small, ideologically empowered group that hates government can actually bring not only government to a halt, but the United States economy to a halt, then the problem we face is far beyond economics. then our entire democracy is really in shambles and essentially not working at all.
Well, we know that Boehner apparently and the president did make a deal over the last weekend, and that was scuttled by Eric Cantor, who also walked out on the meetings with Vice President Biden. The understanding that we have, and none of this is absolutely concrete information, but it's been widely reported, that the president is basically talking about a $4 trillion deal. And a part of that deal is that the Republicans have to relinquish their obsession with protecting the wealthiest 1% in terms of tax cuts. And my understanding is that that would bring in about $800 billion to a trillion in the Treasury. So I see already a tremendous imbalance. If the Republicans are going to contribute only $1 trillion and the president's prepared to cut $3 or $4 trillion, it seems like that's a bad deal.
Oh, it's a terrible deal. I mean, but the deal that the president offered the Republicans, $3 of spending cuts for every dollar of tax increase, would itself undermine major necessary entitlement programs such as Social Security and Medicare. It would cut funding for education for the poor. It would lead to dramatic sacrifices that we should not, as a country, have to make, particularly given that the richest among us, the top 1%, is taking home a higher percentage of the total national income than at any time over the last 80 years. And is facing a lower marginal tax rate than at any time since the 1930s. I mean, this is an absurd situation. And the fact that the president has made this offer is itself troubling enough. But for the Republicans to turn their backs on the offer and say, no, we won't even go that far, we don't want any tax increase whatsoever on the wealthy, is the height of absurdity. I mean, we've now reached the point where irresponsibility reigns. And we'll see. I mean, I have to have faith that John Boehner and Mitch McConnell are reasonable men, even if Eric Cantor and other members of the Republican establishment in Washington are ideologically driven.
Well, but what about the president? Is he too reasonable? In other words, is that stuff still on the table, or was he using it as a bargaining chip? And now they look like he looks like he's gone the extra mile, and they look like petulant teenagers.
Well, clearly, Ian, he has gone the extra mile. He has kind of done a Bill Clinton on them one step further. You remember that. When Newt Gingrich was the firebrand in 1995 and demanded a balanced budget and demanded this and demanded that, Bill Clinton came out sounding and looking very reasonable. He said, of course, I will go that far and I will accommodate what you want. We must not close down the government. And then Gingrich was blamed for closing the government down. Now, not raising the debt ceiling would have far graver consequences than closing the government down, because that would mean all Social Security payments would be suspended, unemployment insurance would be suspended, Medicare would be suspended, and we couldn't even pay our national debts to our national creditors. That would be a far worse situation. So you are absolutely correct in saying that the president has gone beyond the point of being a kind of a reasonable accommodation here. I hope it doesn't stay on the table. I hope that offer that he made was simply that particular offer at that particular time, because it cannot and should not be the offer that wins the day.
Well, you know, with $2 out of 10 in the American pocket coming from the government and from government programs, and them trying to cut government programs, everything is back to front now.
Let me make this even more dramatic.
Couple of seconds, yes.
Yeah, if the president's offer were accepted, the United States would have the largest fiscal contraction, that is, government contraction, of any country right now, beyond even what Britain is doing. And it would plummet us into another great recession, without any doubt.
I thank you so much for joining us here today, Robert Reich.
Thanks, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Reich, who's the author of the new book, Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. He has served in three national administrations, most recently as Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton. He is the Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking further about the economy. It's gonna take money. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining me now is Jeff Madrick, author of the new book, Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the Present. Jeff Madrick is a journalist, economic policy consultant, and analyst. He currently edits Challenge magazine and contributes regularly to the New York Review of Books and the New York Times, in addition to other publications. He's the author of such critically acclaimed books as Taking America, The End of Affluence, and The Case for Big Government. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Madrick.
Thanks for inviting me, Ian.
And, of course, we're talking about the U.S. economy, the age of greed. I think in many ways, Jeff, your subtitle sort of says it all, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America. Now we have an economic hostage crisis here in America, completely fraudulent, generated for naked political reasons, and yet the whole country seems to be sort of sleepwalking and not in any way being outraged. I mean, you got the, you know, the head of the Fed and everybody else are saying the sky is falling, but meanwhile, we just sort of the press reports this economic extortion, this political extortion, as though somehow it's reasonable. I mean,
I think you know, there are a few things going on here. The most important of which is lack of leadership. We don't have any national voice angry as a heck about this. It's one of the great political follies of our history, this argument about how austere our economic program should be at a time when we are creating no jobs. It's stunning. And the press has no serious independent voice in all this. They go with the flow in Washington. And so the right of the right have been unleashed. The right, the pure right, is hampered even by those to the right of them. And the president caved in, we have to remember, caved in on this issue way back when he appointed that commission, Simpson-Bowles Commission, to offer a budget balancing plan. Appointed two conservatives, one very conservative Republican and one conservative Democrat, to come up with this budget balancing plan over time. So he already threw in the towel, claiming our priority is budget balancing. It's hard for me to blame the people for not getting angry about this. They have not been led. They have not been taught. They have not been given the proper information on it.
Well, the extraordinary thing, apart from the president essentially buying into the Republican canard that the economy is somehow connected to the debt and that they're not separate issues to be dealt with separately, the president himself in his recent press conference said, what we need to do is make this big bargain that I'm offering. And clearly the incremental drip, drip, drip of the Republicans is designed for maximum political leverage. Nobody in their right mind would agree to any of their proposals. However, I think he's got the cart before the horse. He's got the whole thing backwards. He said, after we get our big deal signed before the whole roof crashes in, then we're going to get to jobs. Well, God, I mean, but why not start out with jobs,
yeah,
and let and frankly, the job situation will solve the deficit situation if people get back to
work. There's no doubt you're right. And one reason the Democrats lost the last election big is Obama and many Democrats have no idea how big the jobs crisis in America is. It just doesn't seem to be in their heart and soul. It stuns me. I've written about this quite often. They don't seem to get it. I agree with you completely. We have to get the economy running properly again and then deal with balancing the budget. And balancing the budget in the long run, we hear all this panic about huge, huge deficits down the road. Almost all of that has to do with health care, which is driving up Medicare and Medicaid costs and then resulting in higher interest on debt. All of it in the late 2020s. And this idea that we've got to deal with it now, you know, this is the theme of Age of Greed. There was an ideological shift, and the book starts in the 1970s, way back then, compounded over time by the growing political power of Wall Street and of moneyed vested interests. But the ideology, I fear, is something that Obama believes in. He believes government must be small. He believes taxes must be held down. He believes in budget balancing at most times. This is all an ideology that developed right out of the Milton Friedman playbook in the 1970s, and we haven't been able to shake yet. I kind of joke, Ian, that, you know, Obama is part of this 40-something generation that never knew a time when people had faith in government and when government was a place where people were proud to work and get things done and social policies expanded. He has no experience with that. It's kind of a repeat of the Clinton years, and they led to these years.
And of course, I don't know, is it your word, greedism?
I think Paul Krugman and Robin Wells raised it to what might be the term of our time,
right,
in a New York Review of Books piece.
Well,
but greedism is a good way to put it.
And it essentially became sanctified under Ronald Reagan. And I don't know the extent to which the president is somebody that doesn't recognize the Democratic legacy and the importance of the New Deal as it's being slowly undone. However, just in terms of tactics, I just am astounded at his negotiating style, where he comes in asking for much less and ends up with much less.
The New Deal plays a big part in my book, because a lot of the people who led the deregulation wave and the anti-government ideology wave were children of people who hated the New Deal, literally. But there was nothing so distressing to me as Obama reading a biography of Ronald Reagan to seek guidance about how to restore optimism in America. He really should learn something about FDR. FDR was far from perfect, as you know, and the progressives disagreed and thought he wasn't always progressive enough. But when he fought for an awful lot and changed an awful lot. He fought hard, and he called his enemies what they really were. And there was none of this, let's negotiate and play nice, and the golden mean between our points of view is always the answer. He knew he had to get things done. He was quite extraordinary, and he changed the spirit of America and changed the purpose of government in the minds of Americans. And that's the lesson Obama should have learned, instead of some lesson about happy talk that Ronald Reagan was so good at.
Well, Jeff Madrick, somewhere in my files, I've got an audio tape of Ronald Reagan campaigning for Harry Truman in 1948.
Right.
And his speeches then, when he was a union leader and you know, everybody in the country was on the left anyway in those days, just about. Compared to today, they were on the far left.
Right.
His speech back then, his campaign for speech for Harry Truman, is identical to the subsequent speeches that he made in his political comeback leading up to his 1980 election, and all you have to do is substitute in 48, he was saying that big corporations are the enemy. All you have to do is take the word big corporations out and substitute it with big government. It's exactly the same speech.
I think in my book, Age of Greed, I have a chapter on Reagan, and I talk about that. You know, he always needed some big evil monster to attack, and in those periods, when he was still a New Dealer, as you point out, corporations were the evil monster. And then he switched. And the switch, I do talk about the switch. The switch is kind of an interesting phenomenon, but he too was affected by the New Deal. He was so good at fooling himself that he wrote in his second autobiography, An American Life, which was kind of a canned production, he wrote that he believed FDR would have cut down the New Deal over time and cut Social Security. It was quite an extraordinary. The man had a great talent for fooling himself.
Well, Jeff Madrick, the author of the new book, Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the Present. I just spoke also with, there's a nonpartisan group in Washington called the Center for Responsive Politics. They've done a study on this new revolving door between lobbyists and who've become congressional staffers. And apparently, there's been a huge bump in this since this new Congress, and most of these new lobbyists turned congressional staffers are working for Tea Party candidates, which really gives a lie to that whole idea that the Tea Party's in anything but astroturf right-wing front for plutocrats. I mean, they're the worst whores on the hill, this crowd, by the look of it. But the thing that makes me nuts is that all those people on the hill have got jobs. And you were just saying that the political class does not understand the pain in America and the extent to which people are looking for jobs and how long they've been looking for jobs and the need to get this country working again. They give lip service to it, but they don't understand it. In the midst of this, this guy, Ryan, who's trying to eviscerate Medicare and cast our seniors into the poorhouse, by having to pay for stuff that they don't have to pay for now, he's, according to Politico, he's hanging out at the most fancy restaurants in Washington with lobbyists drinking $350 a bottle wine.
Yeah, I have no doubt.
I mean, this is where I don't understand the American people don't see the disconnect between their lives and the lives of these people that are supposed to be representing them.
Well, you know, not too many people are talking about that disconnect. Part of the problem is the press, and the Washington press corps in particular, are part of that world. You know, they party with these people. I'm not saying they're drinking $350 wines, but some of them are probably, and it's pretty distressing. I agree with you. Americans have to understand there is a jobs crisis, but they have to communicate that to people, their representatives in Washington. And I think it's a worse job crisis than even most economists are talking about. Since the recovery in mid-2009, when we're supposed to increase numbers of jobs and wages, profits rose by something like $500 billion, and salaries and wages have risen by something like $5 to $7 billion. That is a stunning fact. There is something very serious going on in America, and there is no evidence the president is paying any attention to this. And I believe it is the ultimate outcome of 40 years of this age of greed, of growing greedism, as we now put it. And, you know, went from politicians to business people to the financial community to crisis after crisis that we told we solved, and we really didn't solve the problem. All along, we have misallocated our precious savings going into financial paper shuffling instead of productive investment, and reinforcing this ideology in which it's hard to talk about what's really going on in America?
Well, that's the question I've always asked people that cover finance that I interview since 2008 and before, is that how long can American capitalism be sustained if at least 40% of it, Wall Street, is based on extracting wealth, not creating wealth? I mean, the original function of Wall Street was supposedly to be the means by which you create wealth, the investment for the robber barons, etc.
You know, they argue that they still create it. It's just simply no longer the case. And so I'm completely with you on that. People, I've been giving a lot of talks. People are very concerned, frankly, just judging by the crowds that come out, you know. And people say, well, what's the happy ending? What do we do? Why, you know, you don't seem to be giving us a way out and so forth. And I can think of solutions. But I tell them, you know, my message is really to alarm you. My message is to have Americans get over the idea that somehow their future is guaranteed. We will muddle through once again and solve our problems the way we always did. We solved our problems in the past by fighting for them. Roosevelt fought rough battles for the things we got in the New Deal. And there are many examples of that before then. But we also made bad decisions, or we developed half solutions, or we waited too long to come up with solutions. We will not necessarily solve the problem of American decline unless people start to understand it is a real possibility that requires action, and maybe even radical action and radical ways of thinking of policy changes.
Well, you would think that the writing's on the wall in terms of the American dream and the Horatio Alger mythology and the whole idea of meritocracy being so manifestly bankrupt at this point, where you have essentially a country increasingly in the grip of corporate plutonomy and of powerful oligarchs like the Koch brothers. It seems so obvious to me, and sometimes I know I sound like a broken record talking about the emerging oligarchy. Now, it did happen before in the Gilded Age, it's not as if, but I would have thought in the hearts and minds of almost every American is this belief that this is supposed to be a middle-class country with equal opportunity. I mean, that's the desire. That's the way we see ourselves.
The end of meritocracy is an important point. We really are increasingly living in a class society. I remember one college president telling me, writing somewhere, tell me what college you go to, and I will tell you what area code, you know, what area code you grew up in, or what my zip code you grew up in, because the demographics of that zip code will determine whether you go to a good school or not, and going to a good school or not in turn determines what kind of job you get. That has occurred increasingly in this country, but it's gotten worse. The idea that wages are not going up at all is stunning,
that's for people who've got a job, for God's sake.
Yeah,
I mean. So, just in closing, then, Jeff Madrick, Paul Krugman, in reviewing your book in the New York Review of Books, concludes that the United States is on a track to spending the better part of the next decade experiencing high unemployment, subpar growth, blighting millions of lives, particularly the old, the young, and the economically vulnerable.
He's right. We're not dealing with our economic problems. We're not expanding the economy.
Well, that shouldn't come as a surprise to anybody who's paying attention to what's happening on Washington. Not only are we not dealing with it, these people are behaving like idiots, like children, like petulant teenagers.
Yeah, they are, but you know, somehow or other, I think people still are afraid of budget deficits, and we've got to understand we need a budget deficit now to get the economy back on track, and the press has to help them understand that, and the press is playing the game of Washington. It's not whether we should balance the budget right now. It's how we do it. Well, the fact is, the question is, should we be thinking about balancing the budget now? We should not. We should be thinking about getting the economy back in on track and figuring out how to make decent-paying jobs in America. And if we don't do that, we're in very deep trouble. And I think the press is handmaiden to the folly.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Jeff Madrick.
It's always a pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
Again, Jeff Madrick is the author of the new book, Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the Present. He's a journalist and an economic policy consultant and an analyst. Currently edits Challenge magazine and contributes regularly to the New York Review of Books, the New York Times, in addition to other publications. He's the author of such critically acclaimed books as Taking America, The End of Affluence, and The Case for Big Government. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment.
I was looking at the ceiling, and then I saw the sky. I was looking at the ceiling, I was looking at the ceiling, I was looking at the ceiling, and then I saw the sky. I was miserable and aching at the way the news kept breaking. I was looking at the ceiling, and then I saw the sky.
Arise and shine, raise your flag with the guiding star, and sing a song of freedom with joy. For peace, liberty, and justice shall forevermore reign. So Lord bless our Sudan, so Lord bless our Sudan.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me now is Rebecca Hamilton. She's an author and journalist who recently returned from Sudan. She was there as a special correspondent on Sudan for the Washington Post and as a Pulitzer Center grantee. Her book, Fighting for Darfur, Public Action in the Struggle to Stop Genocide, came out earlier this year. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rebecca Hamilton.
Thank you.
And you saw the flag go up today at the United Nations for this new country, South Sudan. I take it yesterday you were also in the UN Security Council.
Yes, I watched the UN Security Council meeting yesterday where all of the members on the council decided that they would be recommending to the General Assembly to admit this new nation of South Sudan into the community of the United Nations, and that's exactly what happened today.
But I guess the hallowed halls of the United Nations is a different place from what's happening there on the ground. And when we spoke fairly recently, you were in the disputed area of Abyei, where there was considerable fighting. What's the latest in terms of the reality on the ground as opposed to all of the pomp and ceremony surrounding the admission of a new country to the United Nations?
I have to say it was quite surreal for me yesterday sitting at the UN and hearing them refer to places that I have been speaking to people who've been displaced from lately, like Abyei, like Southern Kordofan, and just a very, very different world, this sort of clean, air-conditioned environment where everybody's speaking politely. It feels very far removed from the realities on the ground. So there's two situations to update on. The first is Abyei, which is a contested area between North and South Sudan that the government, the Sudanese government in the North, seized back in May and displaced 100,000 people as a consequence. Those 100,000 people all fled into the South, and that, for the most part, is where they remain. The Sudanese government is still occupying the Abyei area, and so it is not safe for people to return. They're living in very, very difficult humanitarian conditions. There has been a fuel shortage in the south because of a blockade by the government in the north that has made it very difficult to get relief supplies to those people in the south, plus it's the rainy season. So you have a difficult humanitarian situation in the south as a consequence of Abyei. And then the new development that we've had over the last month is what's happening in Southern Kordofan. And Southern Kordofan is in the northern state, in what is now called Sudan, separate from South Sudan. And what is happening there, has been happening for the last month and continues to happen today, is that the Sudanese government is relentlessly dropping bombs in that area. Now, it's saying that it is doing this to, quote-unquote, cleanse the area of rebel elements. It's absolutely true that there are people in the area who fought with the South, in fact, in the long civil war. But as they drop the bombs, they're also falling on civilians. And we've seen incredible footage, the first really comprehensive video footage put together by Al Jazeera, who managed to get in illegally, has just come out today, really showing the harm that that is causing to civilians who are inside northern Sudan.
Well, Rebecca Hamilton, as you know, George Clooney has taken a considerable interest in Sudan and in Darfur, and he has organized the Satellite Sentinel project. And there are satellite images apparently showing mass graves in this area that you just spoke about. What do you know about that?
I've just read the reporting the same as everybody else on that. We had heard these allegations of mass graves, and I have heard them from people that I've been speaking to on Skype are in southern Kordofan, but I've only been able to get so far secondhand reports of the existence of these mass graves. Now, what the satellite imagery purports to show are images of mass graves. I mean, I have to say, as someone who doesn't know enough about the satellite imagery, it's difficult for me to really make sense of what I'm seeing. But the analysts at the Satellite Sentinel Project have looked at it, and it is their belief that this is an indication of mass graves. What we don't have and what we desperately need is really comprehensive on-the-ground testimony that can explain what happened to get to the point where there are these alleged mass graves in the ground. And the reason that we don't have that information is that the Sudanese government is systematically blocking any outsiders from going in and conducting investigations. And it's not only that they're stopping journalists and human rights organizations from getting in there and really working out what's going on. But they're also stopping humanitarian organizations. And we know without question that so many of the civilians are having to flee into the mountains to try to escape these bombings. With no humanitarian services there for them, we're looking at a secondary humanitarian crisis that follows the death and destruction that is coming from the direct violence of the bombing.
And again, I'm speaking with author and journalist Rebecca Hamilton, who's just recently returned from Sudan and has witnessed the UN Security Council admitting this new country into the Community of Nations, and the flag, of course, being raised at the UN of the new country of South Sudan. The government, of course, of General Omar Bashir has denied that they are bombing the Nuba Mountains and in the South Kordofan area, but he also appeared before his parliament. Now, how does he explain the loss of one-third of his country? And if you look at the map, of course, the north that Bashir now has left, the Republic of Sudan is largely desert except for the Nile Valley, but the south is very green and, you know, with lots of grassland and tropical forest. So how does he explain to his people that they've lost the, you know, not a, by the way, that's also the south where the oil is. So I'm just wondering how he's basically saying everything is fine and we're all going to get along. Meanwhile, he's bombing people. But what about the sense of bitterness in the north that they've lost this jewel?
Yes, President Bashir is in a very difficult position domestically right now because there are a number of northerners who do blame him for having taken power over a united Sudan and having presided over the loss of the most oil-rich part of the country. And I think part of what we're seeing with him sending the army into these areas, into Abyei, into southern Kordofan, is a very, very old tactic. There's nothing like being able to rally domestic support by the construction of a sort of external enemy. And that's what he's saying in southern Kordofan. He's saying that the people that are there, they're rebels, they're enemies of the state, they're trying to overthrow us. We need to mobilize against them. And I think as much as it is an issue that they're concerned that there are rebels there, and they have every right to be concerned about that, but the way to go about it is not to just be bombing wholesale with the enormous civilian casualties that come along with it. It's to actually address the political, underlying political causes that have led people in the Nuba Mountains to have to take up arms over the years to fight for the right to their own identity and to fight for many of the things that, frankly, people in southern Sudan were fighting for, which is the right to be first-class citizens in their own country. And it's the same story of wanting to be first-class citizens in Sudan that you're seeing in the Nuba Mountains, but that you are also have been seeing over the years in Darfur.
Well, it's worth noting here, though, surely, Rebecca Hamilton, that the head of the rest of Sudan, General Omar Bashir, has had an International Criminal Court arrest warrant issued for crimes against humanity during the Darfur 8-year massacres there. There's also an arrest warrant for Ahmed Haroun, who the former Darfur governor, who is now the governor of the area we're talking about that's being bombed, South Kordofan.
Yes, he was formerly in Darfur as, would you believe, working in the Ministry of Humanitarian Affairs, in fact. But you're right, he is now the governor of Southern Kordofan, an election that was contested. The results are disputed by many of the Nuba people who live in the Southern Kordofan area, who were supporting a different candidate. So, yes, you have these same players, Omar al-Bashir, Ahmed Haroun, and the rest of the ruling National Congress Party, who have been there throughout what happened in Darfur and are still in power today. And I think that's, you know, one of the things about what we've seen, all these efforts on Darfur over the years, is that fundamentally, at the end of the day, the people who are most responsible for the atrocities that happened there have remained in power. And it's pretty much the same set of factors that are driving these new conflicts in different parts of the north. And the question, I think, sort of at the back of everybody's minds is, how viable is this new state of Sudan in the north? Is it going to be able to hold these different sections on the periphery together if it doesn't address their political grievances? Back to this core question of, is everybody going to be an equal citizen in this new northern country of Sudan?
And is there any kind of stirrings of the Arab Spring to add to Bashir's woes?
There has been a little bit, and certainly when you saw the initial uprisings, there was quite a lot of excitement among the youth, I would say, in particular, and particularly in Khartoum, in the capital, that maybe this was going to spread over. What they found was that they couldn't really get traction to make it a mainstream enough protest project to really make a difference. What could change with that, though, is the problems that the northern economy is going to be facing now. For a long time, the government in the north has managed to keep a segment of Sudanese society relatively comfortable through a patronage system, and it's been able to do that in recent years because of the huge amount of oil wealth. Now, with 80% of Sudan's oil reserves today now belonging to the new country of South Sudan, the northern economy is in a much more difficult state. And if that does start to affect people's daily lives, then I think the risk of popular protests against Bashir's government do drastically increase.
And of course, if the new country of South Sudan decides to build pipelines through Kenya and Ethiopia to the Indian Ocean, that would put the north out of business altogether in that regard. I thank you for joining us, Rebecca Hamilton.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Rebecca Hamilton, who's an author and journalist. She's recently returned from Sudan. She was there as a special correspondent on Sudan for the Washington Post and as a Pulitzer Center grantee. Her book, Fighting for Darfur, Public Action and the Struggle to Stop Genocide, came out earlier this year.
So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with the former Secretary of Labor, Robert Reich, who served throughout the entire Clinton administration as Secretary of Labor and longer than anybody else. And has become one of the more trenchant critics of the, well, particularly of the Republicans, but he's also, in this case, in our conversation, obviously very critical and very disappointed in the president. And he's negotiating style and he's negotiating strategy, which is frankly baffling. And particularly when you consider that the president's giving away $3 for every dollar he gets back in tax breaks from the Republicans, which they then reneged on. So we were kind of puzzling about trying to figure out what the president put on the table and whether it's still on the table, whether he's still prepared to give away the store in terms of Social Security and Medicaid, not to mention whatever else they agreed to. So it's a very dismal situation, and we try to also analyze what the real leverage is that the president has, since both sides are playing brinksmanship. If the president is trying to get the Republicans, basically trying to nail them with they're the irresponsible ideologues who not just shut down the American government like Newt Gingrich did, but destroyed the full faith and credit of the United States and causing interest rates to rise and nobody gets their Social Security checks, et cetera, et cetera. It's a massive catastrophe if this bluff is called. So the question is, if the Republicans are held responsible for it, it's a Pyrrhic victory for the president because he still ends up with a completely screwed up economy, and yet which he has to deal with for a whole year. Ending, of course, with a resounding defeat in 2012, to be sure. So that's the sort of, obviously Robert Reich seems to think they're going to make some kind of deal. But who knows? At this point, it truly is a disgraceful situation and an alternative universe where all of those people who have jobs in Washington are just playing these irresponsible games like petulant teenagers, while there's real harm and hurt out in the United States. We followed the conversation with Robert Reich with Jeff Madrick, the author of a new book, Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America. Kind of says it all, doesn't it? And that was a very interesting discussion. I thought we learned quite a bit from him. And he has looked into the systemic nature of why these crises happen time and time again. And, of course, they get worse. And nothing was worse than the last one in 2008. And he thinks that we're going to basically have a long, long period, at least a decade-long period of stagnation, high unemployment, and a lot of the standard of living and quality of life of seniors, young, and poor and vulnerable people are going to be adversely affected. In short, the rich will be living in their gated communities, and the rest of us will be, living in this kind of third world, scrabbling without much hope that things are going to get better. So maybe it's a permanent condition. Then finally, we talked to Rebecca Hamilton, who's just back from South Sudan today. South Sudan became the 193rd nation to be admitted into the United Nations amid all kinds of pomp and ceremony on the UN Security Council. But she talked about the reality on the ground back in Sudan, where she just returned from the front, where there's a war going on in the border area. They're bombing the hell out of the Nuba tribe in the mountain. And now George Clooney's people have satellite evidence of mass graves. So it's a very grim picture that she paints amid the hope that this new country is viable. It's got oil, but it's got a lot of problems. And its future is by no means certain. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank my producers Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program's available at ianmasters.com. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.